Hello, angels. It is me, Willow, and I'm back finally doing the thing that I've missed doing so much. I keep telling myself I'm going to start, and then, like, I get really busy, and life is on fire. So, a couple, I guess, weeks ago at this point, I finished reading The Giver by Lois Lowry, and I fell in love with the story, and I very quickly bought the other three books in the quartet of books. And I found out very quickly that the second book does not pick up where the first book left off. It happens at the same time, and then the third book is what comes next. So I ran a poll, and I asked you guys what you might want to listen to. I had A Wrinkle in Time, I had Purgatorio by Dante Alighieri, I had Animal Farm by George Orwell, I had Gathering Blue by Lois Lowry, and I forgot to put Gossamer by Lois Lowry on there as well. I do have that, and I'm thinking about just reading that in, like, one or two parts, because it's only, like, a 100-page story. So it would just be, like, podcast style. Anyway, A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle won, and so I'm here getting ready to start it. It's been a really long time since I've read to you guys, and I miss reading, I'm gonna be totally honest. I don't know how many chapters I'm going to get through because I haven't done this in a long time. I was doing 2 to 3 chapters of The Giver, but every story is different. So we're going to get started. This is the first of the series, so I don't have a go back and listen to the other audios thing. But if you do want to listen to any of the other stories I've read The Great Gatsby by... Why am I blanking? F. Scott Fitzgerald. I've read Inferno by Dante Alighieri, and I have read The Giver by Lois Lowry, and then there's a couple little bits in there from a book called Rejected Princesses. So I've read those things, and they are all on the Safer Work page, like audio index of my Reddit profile, and they can also be found pinned in the media channel of my Discord server. And if you're really brave, you can probably scroll through my Twitter extensively to find it. But I don't suggest that. Anyway, if you're just here for A Wrinkle in Time, we're starting. I'm ready. Grab a drink, get comfy, and get cozy. I do have my window open, so if you hear any, like, ambient noise of, like, people driving by, I apologize. It's really stuffy in this room, and the only way to make it any cooler is to turn the AC on, which I'm not willing to do. To turn another fan on, which I'm not willing to do, because noise. And maybe turn the lights off, and I need the lights to see. So this is what we're getting. Anyway, I have my glasses on. I have something to drink. I am in bed. I'm cozy and I'm comfortable. I have you set on like a little... I finally put a side table in this room, which I've been here for a year now and I haven't done. Anyway, we're starting with chapter one of Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time. I believe that's the first one, right? Yeah. A Wrinkle in Time. And chapter one is called Mrs. What's It? It was a dark and stormy night. In her attic bedroom, Margaret Murray, wrapped in an old patchwork quilt, sat on the foot of her bed and watched the trees tossing in the frenzied lashing of the wind. Behind the trees, clouds scudded frantically across the sky. Every few moments, the moon ripped through them, creating wraith-like shadows that raced along the ground. The house shook. Wrapped in her quilt, Meg shook. She wasn't usually afraid of weather. It's not just the weather, she thought. It's the weather on top of everything else. On top of me. On top of Meg Murray doing everything wrong. School. School was all wrong. She'd been dropped down to the lowest section in her grade. That morning, one of her teachers had said crossly, "Really, Meg, I don't understand how a child with parents as brilliant as yours can be such a poor student. If you don't manage to do a little better, you'll have to stay back next year." During lunch, she'd roughhoused a little to try to make herself feel better, and one of the girls said scornfully, "After all, Meg, we aren't grade school kids anymore. Why do you act like such a baby?" And on the way home from school, as she'd walked up the road with her arms full of books, one of the boys had said something about her dumb baby brother. At this, she'd thrown the books on the side of the road and tackled him with every ounce of strength she had, and arrived home with her blouse torn and a big bruise under one eye. Sandy and Denny's, her 10-year-old twin brothers, who got home from school an hour earlier than she did, were disgusted. "Let us do the fighting when it's necessary," they told her. "A delinquent. That's what I am," she thought grimly. "That's what they'll be saying next. Not mother, but them. Everybody else. I wish father." But it was still not possible to think about her father without the danger of tears. Only her mother could talk about him in a natural way, saying, "When your father gets back?"
Gets back from where? And when?
Surely her mother must know what people were saying, and must be aware of the smugly vicious gossip. Surely it must hurt her as it did Meg. But if it did, she had no outward signs. Nothing ruffled the serenity of her expression. "Why can't I hide it too?" Meg thought. "Why do I always have to show everything?" The window rattled madly in the wind, and she pulled the quilt closer about her. Curled up on one of her pillows, a gray fluff of kitten yawned, showing its pink tongue, tucked its head under again, and went back to sleep. Everybody was asleep. Everybody except Meg. Even Charles Wallace, the dumb baby brother, who had an uncanny way of knowing when she was awake and unhappy, and who would come so many nights tiptoeing up the attic stairs to her. Even Charles Wallace was asleep. How could they sleep? All day on the radio there had been hurricane warnings. How could they leave her up in the attic in the rickety brass bed, knowing that the roof might have blown off the house, and she tossed out into the wild night sky to land who knows where? Her shivering grew uncontrollable. "You asked to have the attic bedroom," she told herself savagely. "Mother let you have it because you're the oldest. It's a privilege, not a punishment." "Not during a hurricane, it isn't a privilege," she said out loud. She tossed the quilt down to the foot of the bed and stood up. The kitten stretched luxuriously and looked up at her with huge, innocent eyes. "Go back to sleep," Meg said. "Just be glad you're a kitten and not a monster like me." She looked at herself in the wardrobe mirror and made a horrible face, bearing a mouthful of teeth covered with braces. Automatically, she pushed her glasses into position and ran her fingers through her mouse brown hair so that it stood wildly on end, and let out a sigh almost as noisy as the wind. The wide wooden floorboards... Wow, I said that word really weird. The wide wooden floorboards were cold against her feet. Wind blew in the crevices of the window frame, in spite of the protection from the storm sash. In spite of the protection the storm sash was supposed to offer, she could hear wind howling in the chimneys. From all the way downstairs, she could hear Fortinbras? Oh, cool. That's a name. The big black dog start to bark. He must be frightened, too. What was he barking at? He never barked without reason. Suddenly, she remembered that when she had gone to the post office to pick up the mail, she'd heard about a tramp who was supposed to have stolen 12 sheets from Mrs. Buncombe, the constable's wife. They hadn't caught him, and maybe he was heading for the Murray's house right now, isolated on a back road as it was. And this time, maybe he'd be after more than sheets. Meg hadn't paid much attention to the talk about the tramp at the time, because the postmistress, with a sugary smile, had asked if she'd heard from her father lately. She'd left her little room and made her way through the shadows of the main attic, bumping against the ping-pong table. "Now I'll have a bruise on my hip on top of everything else," she thought. Next, she walked into her old dollhouse, Charles Wallace's rocking horse and the twins' electric trains. "Why must everything happen to me?" she demanded of a large teddy bear. At the floor of the attic stairs, she stood still and listened. Not a sound from Charles Wallace's room, on the right. On the left, her parents' room, not a rustle from her mother, sleeping alone in the great double bed. She tiptoed down the hall and into the twins' room, pushing again at her glasses as though they could help her see better in the dark. Denny's was snoring. Sandy was murmuring something about baseball, and then it subsided. The twins didn't have any problems. They weren't great students, but they weren't bad ones either. They were perfectly content with a succession of B's and an occasional A or C. They were strong and fast runners and good at games, and when cracks were made about anybody in the Murray family, they weren't made about Sandy and Denny's. She left the twins' room and went on downstairs, avoiding the creaking seventh step. The dog hadn't stopped barking. It wasn't the tramp this time, then. Fort would go on barking if anybody was around. But suppose the tramp does come? Suppose he has a knife? Nobody lives near enough to hear if we screamed and screamed and screamed. Nobody'd care, anyhow. I'll make myself some cocoa, she decided. That'll cheer me up, and if the roof blows off, at least I won't go with it. In the kitchen, a light was already on, and Charles Wallace was sitting at the table drinking milk and eating bread and jam. He looked very small and vulnerable sitting there alone in a big old-fashioned kitchen. A blonde little boy in faded blue Dr. Denson's, his feet swinging a good 6 inches above the floor. Hi, he said cheerfully. I've been waiting for you. From under the table where he was lying at Charles Wallace's feet, hoping for a crumb or two, the dog raised his slender dark head in greeting to Meg, and his tail thumped against the floor. Fort had arrived on their doorstep, a half-grown puppy, scrawny and abandoned, one winter night. He was, Meg's father had decided, part Llewellyn Setter and part Greyhound, and he had a slender, dark beauty that was all his own. "Why didn't you come up to the attic?" Meg asked her brother, speaking as though he were at least her own age. "I've been scared stiff." "Too windy up in that attic of yours," the little boy said. "I knew you'd be down. I put some milk on the stove for you. It ought to be hot by now." How did Charles Wallace always know about her? How could he always tell? He never knew, or seemed to care, what Denny's or Sandy's was thinking. It was his mother's mind and Meg's that he probed with frightening accuracy. Was it because people were a little afraid of him that they whispered about the Murray's youngest child, who was rumored to be not quite bright? "I've heard that clever people often have subnormal children," Meg had once overheard. The two boys seemed to be nice, regular children, but that unattractive girl and the baby boy certainly aren't all there. It was true that Charles Wallace seldom spoke with anybody when anybody was around, so that many people thought he'd never learned to talk at all. And it was true that he hadn't talked at all until he was at least almost 4. Meg would turn white with fury when people looked at him and clucked, shaking their heads sadly. "Don't worry about Charles Wallace, Meg," her father had once told her. Meg remembered very clearly because it was shortly before he went away. "There's nothing the matter with his mind. He just does things in his own way, in his own time. I don't want him to grow up and be dumb like me," Meg had said. "Oh, my darling, you're not dumb," her father answered. "You're like Charles Wallace. Your development has to go at its own pace. It doesn't just happen to be the usual pace." "How do you know?" Meg had demanded. "How do you know I'm not dumb? Isn't it just because you love me?" "I love you, but that's not what tells me. Mother and I have given you a number of tests, you know." That was true. Meg had realized some of the games her parents played with her were tests of some kind, and that there had been more for her and Charles Wallace than there had been for the twins. "IQ tests, you mean?" "Yes, some of them." "Is my IQ okay?" "More than okay." "What is it?" "That I'm not going to tell you, but it assures me that both you and Charles Wallace will be able to do pretty much whatever you want when you grow up yourselves. You just wait till Charles Wallace starts to talk. You'll see." How right had he been about that? Though he himself had left before Charles Wallace began to speak. Suddenly, with none of the usual baby preliminaries, using entire sentences. How proud he would have been. "You better check the milk," Charles Wallace said to Meg now, his dictation clearer and cleaner than that of most 5-year-olds. "You know you don't like it when it gets a skin on top." "You put in more than twice enough milk," Meg peered into the saucepan. Charles Wallace nodded serenely. "I thought Mother might like some." I think I'm missing a page here. I am, hold on. Those 2 pages stuck together because I haven't opened this book yet. "I might like what?" a voice said, and there was their mother standing in the doorway. "Cocoa," Charles Wallace said. "Would you like a liverwurst and cream cheese sandwich? I'd be happy to make you one." "That would be lovely," Mrs. Murray said, "but I can make it myself if you're busy." "No trouble at all," Charles Wallace said, sliding down from his chair and trotted over to the refrigerator, his pajamaed feet padding softly as a kitten's. "How about you, Meg?" he asked. "Sandwich?" "Yes, please," she said, "but not liverwurst. Do we have any tomatoes?" Charles Wallace peered into the crisper. "One." "All right, if I use it on Meg, Mother." "To what better use could it be put?" Mrs. Murray smiled. "But not so loud, please, Charles. That is, unless you want the twins downstairs, too." "Let's be exclusive," Charles Wallace said. "That's my new word for the day. Impressive, isn't it?" "Prodigious," Mrs. Murray said. "Meg, come. Let me look at that bruise." Meg knelt at her mother's feet.
The warmth and light of the kitchen had relaxed her so that her attic fears were gone. The cocoa steamed fragrantly in the saucepan. Geraniums bloomed in the windowsills, and there were a bouquet of tiny yellow chrysanthemums in the center of the table.
Excuse me.
The curtains, red and with a blue and green geometrical patterns, were drawn and seemed to reflect the cheerfulness throughout the room. The furnace purred like a great sleepy animal. The lights glowed with steady radiance outside, alone in the dark. The wind battered against the house, but the angry power that had frightened Meg while she was alone in the attic was subdued by the familiar comfort of the kitchen. Underneath Mrs. Murray's chair, Fort let out a contented sigh. Mrs. Murray gently touched Meg's bruised cheek. Meg looked up at her mother, half in loving admiration, half in sullen resentment. It was not an advantage to have a mother who was a scientist and a beauty as well. Mrs. Murray's flaming red hair, creamy skin, and violet eyes with dark lashes. With long, dark lashes. I lied to you. I missed a word there. Seemed even more spectacular in comparison to Meg's outrageous plainness. Meg's hair had been passable as long as she wore it in tidily in braids. When she went into high school, it was cut. Now she and her mother struggled with putting it up, but one side would come out curly and the other straight, so that she looked even plainer than before. "You don't know the meaning of moderation, do you, my darling?" Mrs. Murray asked. "A happy medium is something I wonder if you'll ever learn. That's a nasty bruise the Henderson boy gave you." By the way, shortly after he'd gone to bed, his mother called up to complain about how badly you'd hurt him. I told her that since he's a year older and at least 25 pounds heavier than you are, I thought I was the one who ought to be doing that complaining. But she seemed to think it was all your fault. "I suppose that depends on how you look at it," Meg said. "Usually, no matter what happens, people think it's my fault. Even if I have nothing to do with it at all. But I'm sorry. I tried to fight him. It's just been an awful week, and I'm full of bad feeling." Mrs. Murray stroked Meg's shaggy head. "Do you know why?" "I hate being an oddball," Meg said. "It's hard on Sandy and Denny's, too. I don't know if they're really like everybody else, or if they're just able to pretend they are. I try to pretend, but it isn't any help." "You're much too straightforward to be able to pretend to be what you aren't," Mrs. Murray said. "I'm sorry, Meglet. Maybe if Father were here to help you, but I don't think I can do anything till you've managed to plow through some more time. Then things will be easier for you. But that isn't much help right now, is it? Maybe if I weren't so repulsive looking. Maybe if I were pretty like you." "Mother's not a bit pretty. She's beautiful," Charles Wallace announced, slicing liverwurst. "Therefore, I bet she was awful at your age." "How right you are," Mrs. Murray said. "Just give yourself some time, Meg." "Lettuce on your sandwich, Mother?" Charles Wallace asked. "No, thanks." He cut the sandwich into sections, put it on a plate, and set it in front of his mother. "Yours will be along in just a minute, Meg. I think I'll talk to Mrs. Wetsit about you." "Who's Mrs. Wetsit?" Meg asked. "I think I want to be exclusive about her for a while," Charles Wallace said. "Onion salt?" "Yes, please." "What's Mrs. Wetsit stand for?" Mrs. Murray asked. "That's her name," Charles Wallace answered. "You know the old shingled house in the woods that kids won't go near because they say it's haunted? That's where they live."
"They?"
"Mrs. Wetsit and her two friends. I was out with Ford a couple days ago. You and the twins were at school, Meg. We liked to walk in the woods, and suddenly he took off after a squirrel, and I took off after him, and we ended up by the haunted house. So I met them by accident, you might say."
"But nobody lives there," Meg said.
"Mrs. Wetsit and her friends do. They're very enjoyable."
"Why didn't you tell me about it before?" Mrs. Murray asked.
"And you know you're not supposed to go off our property without permission, Charles."
"I know," Charles said.
"That's one reason I didn't tell you. I just rushed off after Fortinbras without thinking. And then I decided, well, I'd better save them for an emergency after how. Oh, anyhow." A fresh gust of wind took the house and shook it, and suddenly the rain began to lash against the windows. "I don't think I like this wind," Meg said nervously. "We'll lose some of the shingles off the roof, that's certain," Mrs. Murray said. "But this house has stood for almost 200 years, and I think it'll last a little bit longer, Meg. There's been many a high wind up on this hill."
"But this is a hurricane," Meg wailed. "The radio kept saying it was a hurricane."
"It's October," Mrs. Murray told her. "There have been storms in October before."
As Charles Wallace gave Meg her sandwich, Fortinbras came out from under the table. He gave a long, low growl, and you could see the dark fur slowly rising on his back. Meg felt her own skin prickle. "What's wrong?" she asked anxiously. Fortinbras started towards the door that opened into Mrs. Murray's laboratory, which was in the old stone dairy right off the kitchen. Beyond the lab pantry led outdoors, though Mrs. Murray had done her best to train the family to come in the house through the garage door or the front door and not through her lab. It was the lab door and not the garage door to which Fortinbras was growling. "You didn't leave any nasty-smelling chemicals cooking over the Bunsen burner, did you, Mother?" Charles Wallace asked. "No," Mrs. Murray stood up. "But I think I'd better go see what's upsetting Fort anyhow." "It's the tramp. I'm sure it's the tramp," Meg said nervously. "What tramp?" Charles Wallace asked. "They were saying at the post office this afternoon that a tramp stole all of Mrs. Buncombe's sheets." "We'd better sit on the pillowcases then," Mrs. Murray said lightly. "I don't think a tramp would be out on a night like this, Meg." "That's probably why he is out," Meg wailed, "trying to find a place not to be out." "In which case, I'll offer him the barn till morning," Mrs. Murray said briskly as she walked to the door. "I'll go with you." Meg's voice was shrill. "No, Meg, you stay with Charles and eat your sandwich." "Eat!" Meg exclaimed as Mrs. Murray went through the lab. "How does she expect me to eat?" "Mother can take care of herself," Charles said. "Physically, that is." But he sat in Father's chair at the table, and his legs kicked out at the rungs. And Charles Wallace, unlike most small children, had the ability to sit still. After a few moments that seemed like forever to Meg, Mrs. Murray came back, holding the door open for... Was it the tramp? It seemed small for Meg's idea of a tramp. The age or sex was impossible to tell, for it was completely bundled up in clothes. Several scarves of assorted colors were tied around the head, and a man's felt hat perched atop. A shocking pink stole what was knotted around a rough overcoat, and black rubber boots covered the feet. "Mrs. What's-it?" Charles said suspiciously. "What are you doing here, and at this time of night?" "Now, don't you be worried, my honey," a voice emerged from among turned-up collar, stole, scarves, and hat, a voice like an unoiled gate, but somehow not unpleasant. Mrs. What's-it says she lost her way," Mrs. Murray said. "Would you care for some hot chocolate, Mrs. What's-it?" "Charmed, I'm sure," Mrs. What's-it answered, taking off the hat and the stole. "It isn't so much that I lost my way as that I got blown off course. And when I realized that I was at little Charles Wallace's house, I thought I'd just come in, rest a bit before proceeding on my way." "How did you know this was Charles Wallace's house?" Meg asked. "By the smell." Mrs. Wallace untied a blue and green paisley scarf, a red and yellow flowered print, a gold Liberty print, a red and black bandana. Under all of this was a sparse quantity of grayish hair, and was tied in a small but tidy knot on top of her head. Her eyes were bright, her nose a round, soft blob, her mouth puckered like an autumn apple. "My, but it's lovely and warm in here," she said. "Do you sit down?" Mrs. Murray indicated to a chair. "Would you like a sandwich, Mrs. What's-it?" "I've had liverwurst and cream cheese. Charles has bread and jam, and Meg, lettuce and tomato." "Now let me see," Mrs. What's-it pondered. "I'm passionately fond of Russian caviar." "You peaked," Charles cried indignantly. "We're saving that for Mother's birthday, and you can't have any." Mrs. What's-it gave a deep, pathetic sigh. "No," Charles said. "Now you mustn't give it to her, Mother, or I shall be very angry. What about tuna fish salad?" "All right," Mrs. What's-it said meekly. "I'll fix it," Meg offered, going to the pantry for a can of tuna fish. I'm shifting how I'm sitting, I'm sorry. "For crying out loud," she thought. "This old woman comes barging in on us in the middle of the night, and Mother takes it as though it weren't anything peculiar about it at all. I'll bet she is the tramp. I'll bet she did steal those sheets. And she certainly... She is certainly no one Charles Wallace ought to be friends with, especially when he won't even talk to ordinary people." "I've only been in the neighborhood a short time," Mrs. What's-it was saying as Meg switched off the pantry light and came back into the kitchen with the tuna fish. And I didn't think I was going to like the neighbors at all until dear Charles came over with his dog. Mrs. What's it? Charles Wallace demanded severely. Why did you take Mrs. Buncombe's sheets? Well, I needed them, Charles dear. You must return them at once. But Charles dear, I can't. I've used them. It was very wrong of you, Charles Wallace scolded. If you needed sheets that badly, you could have asked me. Mrs. What's it shook her head and clucked. You can't spare any sheets. Mrs. Buncombe can't. Meg cut up some celery and mixed it with the tuna. After a moment's hesitation, she opened the refrigerator door and brought out a jar of little sweet pickles. That's why I'm doing it for her, I don't know. Oh, though why I'm doing it for her, I don't know, she thought, as she cut them up. I don't trust her one bit. Tell your sister I'm all right, Miss Watson said to Charles. Tell her my intentions are good. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, Charles intoned. My, but isn't he coming? Mrs. Watson beamed at him fondly, and lucky he has someone to understand him. But I'm afraid he doesn't, Mrs. Murray said. None of us is quite up to Charles. But at least you aren't trying to squash him down, Mrs. Watson nodded her head vigorously. You're letting him be himself. Here's your sandwich, Meg said, bringing it to Mrs. Watson. Do you mind if I take off my boots before I eat? Mrs. Wessett asked, picking at the sandwich nevertheless. Listen. She moved her feet up and down in her boots, and they could hear water squelching. My toes are ever so damp. The trouble is that these boots are a mite too tight for me, and I can never get them off by myself. I'll help you, Charles offered. Not you. You're not strong enough. I'll help. Mrs. Murray squatted at Mrs. Wessett's feet, yanking on one slick boot. When the boot came off, it came off suddenly. Mrs. Murray sat down with a thump. Mrs. Watson went tumbling backwards with the chair onto the floor, sandwich held high in one old claw. Water poured out of the boot and ran over the floor and onto the big braided rug. Oh, dearie me, Mrs. Watson said, lying on her back in the overturned chair, her feet in the air and one in a red and white striped sock, the other still booted. Mrs. Murray got to her feet. Are you all right, Mrs. Watson? If you have some liniment, I'll put it on my dignity, Mrs. Watson said, still supine. I think it's sprained. A little oil of cloves mixed with garlic is rather good, as she took a large bite of the sandwich. Do please get up, Charles said. I don't like seeing you lying there that way. You're carrying things too far. Have you ever tried to get off your feet with a sprained dignity? But Mrs. Watson scrambled righted the chair, and then sat back down on the floor. The booted foot stuck out in front of her as she took another bite. She moved with great agility for such an old woman. At least Meg was reasonably sure she was an old woman, and a very old woman at that. Mrs. Watson, her mouth full, ordered Mrs. Murray, "Now pull while I'm already down." Quite calmly, as though this old woman in her boots were nothing out of the ordinary, Mrs. Murray pulled until the second boot relinquished the foot. This foot was covered in a blue and gray argyle sock, and Mrs. Watson sat there, wiggling her toes, contently finishing her sandwich before scrambling to her feet. Ah, she said. That's ever so much better, and took both boots and shook them out over the sink. My stomach is full, and I'm warm inside and out. It's time I went home. Don't you think you better stay till morning? Mrs. Murray asked. Oh, thank you, dearie, but there's so much to do, I just can't waste time sitting around frivoling. It's much too wild a night to travel in. Wild nights are my glory, Mrs. Watson said. I just got caught in a downdraft and blown off course. Well, at least till your socks are dry. Wet socks don't bother me. I just didn't like the water squishing around in my boots. Now don't worry about me, lamb. Lamb was not a word one would ordinarily think of calling Mrs. Murray. I shall sit down for a moment and pop my boots all back on, and I'll be on my way. Speaking of ways, pet, there is such a thing as a tesseract. Mrs. Murray went very white and with one hand reached backwards and clutched the chair for support. Her voice trembled. What did you say? Mrs. Watson tugged on her second boot. I said, she grunted, shoving her foot down, that there is, shove, such a thing, shove, as a tesseract. Her foot went down into the boot and grabbing shawls and scarves and hat, she hustled out the door. Mrs. Murray stayed very still, making no move to help the old woman. As the door opened, Fortinbras peeked in, panting, wet and shiny as a seal. He looked at Mrs. Murray and whined. The door slammed.
Mother, what's the matter? Meg cried. What did she say? What is it? The Tesseract, Mrs. Murray whispered. What does she mean? How could she have known? I'm gonna call it there because we're 30 minutes in, but that's chapter one and a good 24 pages. And I'm excited. The second chapter is called Mrs. Who. Thank you for bearing with me. I know I stumbled over my words a lot. I'm just getting back into the habit of reading out loud. So it'll take a part or two for me to get used to it again. Also, I have the hiccups. Anyway, I love you all very much. Continue to be kind to each other. Reach out to me if you ever need anything. And sleep well, my angels.